The Week on Selbury Hill by Adam Thorpe. The author and his wife recently made a trip to India, where they were lucky enough to be invited to attend an ancient pre-Hindu ritual in the very early hours of the morning in a remote village on the Malabar coast. It was an experience that fed directly into his lifelong fascination with the power and meaning of Wiltshire's 4,300-year-old Selbury Hill. The reader is Philip Franks.
We were the only Westerners, yet we were urged by the spectators to stand at the front, so close that when the frenzied attendants kicked the small red-hot heap of embers, it snowed around us. The men, dressed as gods in fantastic goggle-eyed masks and elaborate costumes, were in a trance state after weeks of fasting in isolation. This was a role they had inherited in a tradition that may originally date from Neolithic times, unique to the area around Kannur, and traditionally performed by the lower castes, an astonishing reversal of status in an unbending system. They weren't playing the gods, of course. They were possessed by them, assuming their supernatural powers from the moment they looked into the mirror. Some dozen drums, cymbals, and a plaintive horn kept up a ceaseless accompaniment. We moved, after an hour or so, to an adjoining, much larger area, in which, to my astonishment, a simulacrum of Selbury Hill glowed. A huge mound of charcoal embers, whose heat pulsed fiercely on our faces through the tropical night air. Onto this scorching tump, kept fired up by attendants with rakes, the two red and yellow gods were thrown repeatedly face forwards by means of flexible handles of cord, then abruptly tugged back until their voluminous skirts of coconut leaves had to be periodically doused by pails of water fetched from an oil drum next to us. Each shove onto the embers was accompanied by shouted chants from the attendants, raggedly pacing and dancing around the incandescent mound. But the spectators, hundreds of local devotees, watched in awed silence. The masked men looked like giant puppets when thrown and dragged off, but they were all too real. When dawn came, I felt energized and extraordinarily positive. Selbury as the simulacrum of a heap of glowing embers. Why not? Later, I asked a man fishing for trout why the men did not get burnt during that particular kolam. Because, he said, as if it was obvious, they have the god inside them. Theyam, with its fearful masks and danger and flickering light, is both an art form and a mystic rite. Each kolam ceremony represents a different legend. It is storytelling theatre, sacred ritual, and fantastical dance combined. This is the kind of fleshed-out and verbal context that the prehistoric monuments have lost. We have only the debris of a vast imagination. The million man-hours estimated to have been consumed by the making of Selbury Hill, or the Avebury Stone Circle, would have needed more than a feeling that this sweaty toil was nourishing the soul, or the peculiar satisfaction that individuals get out of working as a crew. If not some material reward, then a sense of edging towards some astonishing finality. Nevertheless, to us it seems a touch lunatic. Take the dragging of the sarsens. The action of shifting those great stones only seems mad because we have lost the narrative, the context. There may even have been a real narrative behind it, in the sense of an old epic story involving heroes and gods. At the Avebury ceremony on All Hallows' Eve, fire glows and sparkles and swoops about as we walk across the northeast arc to where the labyrinth is now a hive of activity. My wife Jo and our old friends Sasha and Ray have joined me. Tiny wigwam-like structures pulse golden from within. Paraffin lamps shine like white stars, while a plethora of blue or green glow sticks introduce a modern party note. Otherwise, in the gaps, as it were, it is very dark. The drums sound rhythmically, and flames flicker from a tripod-hung cauldron in the labyrinth's centre. a long and doleful queue has built up, each person having to endure a whispered rite of passage with a man pretending to be bent and ancient and disagreeable in a cloak and hood. He holds a large stick. Words erupt from him in a guttural snarl.
"Do you mean this? Selfish! You've jumped the queue! Next!"
Now and again he roars like a maniac.
"You may not come in!"
And shakes the stick with great violence. The reason for the refusal I cannot fathom, although I stand as close as I dare.
"You may walk around, but not come in."
Someone in a green man cloak informs us that you walk the labyrinth to banish something negative from the last year, having written it down on a slip of paper, which you throw into the central cauldron when you reach it. If the gatekeeper feels you haven't thought hard enough about your negative thing, you are turned away. It is a ham performance, but its authentic seriousness makes it eerie, almost troubling. Even the druidically dressed can be refused. Even those done up in animal skins with little leather pouches, or long woolen robes like extras from Lord of the Rings. Joe suggests I give it a go, as I've had a pretty negative year, but the idea of being refused puts me off. The reward of entry is to walk the labyrinth slowly, holding a short lurid green glow stick. It reminds me of shuffling towards security in crowded airports. I know, of course, that if I were to succeed in entering, I would be feeling quite differently. Rituals work best for those undertaking them. This is not Thayam, not that god-thumped glowing mound. Nevertheless, the shuffling figures look melancholic, a slow meandering of negative thoughts. Someone ill, a death, a divorce, a bully at work, creates a vortex that plunges away in the middle. It all makes a tense contrast with the fire dancing, the drumming and whooping and general rattle-shaking going on around the edge and off towards the stones. We circle the labyrinth's perimeter. The burning charcoal smell, the odd figure in stitched-hide dress crouched over a steaming pot, help to persuade that this is about as close as one can ever get, in England at least, to experiencing what might have happened in the stone circles when they were functioning. The crucial element is the sweaty atmosphere of belief. This is not an English heritage recreation. These people, however hammily theatrical the whole business seems, are dead serious. Just as Holy Communion, in the politest of Anglican churches, is dead serious, with its potent words, its sweet whiffs of wine, its murmurings at the altar rail, its ritual cleansing of negativity. I notice something extraordinary, suddenly. Passing the one great sarsen still upright in the stripped northeast sector, stone 201, a lone sentinel from the inner circle, I notice how the fire play is sending shadows dancing over the stone's broad flank. Human shadow figures weave in and out, larger and smaller depending on their distance from the light source, which itself is ever-changing. I am amazed. It is like an art film, a projection using backlighting, fade-out, diffusers, and dissolve. The stone lends itself peculiarly well as a screen, being pale and flat and smooth, apart from two horizontal gouges that move as the light moves and turns the stone to something rippling and febrile and alive. I stare transfixed. Imagine the procession down Avebury's two avenues. Even the most level-headed scholar thinks it probable that fire and dancing would have been integral to any ceremonial rite. The avenue's stones would have served as natural screens, their flattish sides creating a parallel shadow realm in which the shamans or priests reared and pranced and grew suddenly enormous, endlessly shape-shifting, the stones glowing and pulsating as the projected flame-light struck. How did the prehistoric mind interpret the casting of shadows? Not as a physical process of blocked light rays, obviously, but perhaps as a poesis of spirit, the subtle body escaping the flesh, the revelation of the mysterious thisness that survives death and dissolution. This is what strikes me, watching the complex shadow dance on the great solitary stone. I see it as a capturing, not a projection, a kind of X-ray of whatever spirit skeleton lies inside us. And now this spirit has become other somehow, independent, freed, shape-shifting. The dance of the dead who are also alive. The veil between, ripped. It must be the drumming that's encouraging this trance-like suspension of disbelief. I have certainly not imbibed of any suspect substances. It is simply the power of the image, moving as I have seen the Uffington white horse move under a full moon scudded over by swift clouds, as the painted Paleolithic animals moved and rippled under the firelight of torches on the uneven cave rock of Lascaux and Chavay. Shadows must have been a central element to prehistoric lives. Making animal silhouettes from your bare hands is something we learn as children. In a world of natural, uncertain light and much more darkness, this would have been a primary imaginative impulse. Light and shadow. Exactly the elements that no archaeologist will ever recover. Nothing could be more ephemeral. Ordinary sunlight does not appear to move unless flecked by shifting leaves in a wood. Flame light, candle, torch, or blazing fire, is an artificial light that moves ceaselessly. The great French cinematographer Henri Acquelon points out that not only is such light a statement of human power and control in a bewilderingly diffident universe, but that its unsettled, unsteady quality conjures complex feelings, mixing the precise and the imprecise, what is designated and what is unexpressed. The irrational, in other words. A hidden world. This is what I felt on watching the shadow play on the great Sarsen stone. That night in bed, I picture Silbury's great chalk-white hulk as it was back then, as sometimes we can glimpse it now when the grass is covered by snow. If a person, whether antlered shaman or something quite other, were to place themselves, perhaps using a timber platform over the flooded ditch, between the hill's sloped flank and a correctly positioned fire in the depths of night, and then approach the fiery, unsteady light source, their figure would loom and stretch up the white blank of the hill. If many dancing figures were to join in, the spectacle would be breathtaking and reflected in the flooded ditch beneath. A performance in the round. Water transfigured by flame in the usual fantastical alchemy. Fires spaced as they were spaced around that Wiccan labyrinth, burning like jewels in a great ring. The shadow dance visible from wherever you squatted. Faces looking up, agape. Of course this wasn't conceived of when the first basket load of gravel was emptied, the first mud tumps patted into shape, but ingenuity and accident, and maybe a dose of genius, might have played their part as the hill rose whitely and the spring's water trickled into the ditch. Perhaps nothing as spectacular and lovely has ever been created since on our islands. No work of art, or architecture, or technological achievement. And what we have now is the mere husk. And yet even this husk is extraordinary. A relic reduced to pure form, onto whose grassy sides the shadows of our own imaginings are still projected and absorbed for as long as we are still around, stumbling and sometimes dancing through life towards unknown realms of darkness.
Philip Franks was reading from On Silbury Hill by Adam Thorpe. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for Radio 4. Woman's Hour meets a socialist and sexual reformer in a couple of minutes, but first a look ahead to 11 this morning and some unexpected events that developed around a pub in Luton.
Lives in a Landscape returns to BBC Radio 4, sharing real stories from all over Britain.
The Roman Way pub, built in.
Probably 1966 it opened.
So it's coming up to 50 years old.
Yep.
Will it make it?
No.
Beginning with the community's response to the closure of their local.
The operation is Operation Squat. Operation to get in the premises.
We got the keys! We got the keys! We got the keys!
Lives in a Landscape. Starting this morning at 11 on BBC Radio 4.